its citizens without unwarranted surveillance. I see a society where war is not an option. Thank you. And the negotiation with mutual respect is the hallmark rather than mutual self-destruction. I see a society where the welfare of all, I see a society where the welfare of all is equally important as the riches of the few. I see a world that discusses solutions without demanding its own answers. We have given war, pestilence, hate, greed, judgment, ego, self-sufficiency a good try and have failed. We need a new paradigm that consists of kindness, courtesy, justice, love, and respect in all our relationships. Work hard.
That was Dr. George Tiller, assassinated May 31st, 2009, in his own church on Sunday. Thanks to Mark Bretzfelder for that videotape. And that does it for our broadcast. Also, thanks to Cheryl Chasteen, the medical director and primary abortion provider at Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, Kansas, the former clinic of Dr. George Tiller. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Rourke, Renee Felsar, Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karen, Dina Gester, Amy Littlefield. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. The keynote speaker will be Sherry Hunkala, a national activist in anti-poverty movements and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 14th Annual Village Building Convergence. From Friday, May 23rd, to Sunday, June 1st. The Village Building Convergence is a 10-day placemaking and urban permaculture festival that leaves a permanent, sustainable impact all across the city as an expression of what communities all across the city are ready to do in their own places. The VBC brings together a vast spectrum of related initiatives, such as community currency, grassroots democracy, ecological design, youth engagement, social justice in action, ecological stewardship, multimodal transportation, and so much more. This year's evening speakers and performers will be at the Sunnyside Methodist Church, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. A list of speakers and more information about the Village Building Convergence in general can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Supreme Court declines to halt Oregon gay marriages.
400 Oregon National Guard troops will be deployed to Afghanistan.
And as radioactive water continues to leak into the Pacific Ocean, Japan begins construction on an ice wall at the shuttered Fukushima nuclear plant.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. The U.S. Supreme Court announced today that it will not halt same-sex marriages in Oregon while a lower court considers an appeal to the lifting of the state's gay marriage ban. The stay of same-sex marriages was sought by the National Organization for Marriage, a right-wing conservative group opposed to gay civil rights. The group is seeking to overturn last month's ruling by District Court Judge Michael McShane that the voter-approved 2004 state constitutional ban of gay marriage is unconstitutional. Nationally, 10 states which had their gay marriage ban struck down are currently in the appeals process.
One of the items introduced at this morning's City Council meeting in Portland was a proposal to implement a late-night license for bars and clubs which are open after 10 p.m. The proposal was drafted by the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and other groups under the guise of preserving public safety. But music performers and venues have argued that this is just the latest element in what they call an assault on night culture in Portland. Earlier this year, several promoters organized a campaign to challenge the recent increase in police and fire marshal raids of music shows, particularly those involving minority performers. Former Willamette Week music editor Casey Jarman, who is now with Party Damage Records, issued a public statement saying that he believes the city has engaged in a concerted effort to target and preemptively silence artists in Portland. Today's proposal comes on the heels of a proposal last week introduced by several dozen Portland club and bar owners that they would like to have more power to self-police the area around their clubs.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales today asked the City Council to delay the vote on a contentious street fee on businesses until after the election in November. The Council considered three related items this morning and voted on one of them. At last week's meeting, they voted to approve a $6 a month residential fee, but delayed implementation until after the business street fee is approved. Here's Hales at the City Council meeting this morning.
There is interest in moving forward in time for the November election on the referral to the voters of the charter restriction. However, there's still some more work that needs to be done fine-tuning the language of that charter restriction. So it's my intention when we get to that item to set that over for 1 week so that we can finish wordsmithing the words of that resolution, of that charter change. The sense of the charter change is not going to vary, which is the purpose of the charter change is to restrict the use of transportation user fee revenues to transportation purposes. And exactly how we state that in words in the charter, again, we're going to work on for another week and bring it back to council in time to refer it to the November ballot, because that's when people get to vote on charter changes, is in an election, and we have one coming. And we have a few more weeks in which we can refer something to the voters and get it acted on in November. It's my intention to continue council discussion and a public hearing on item 546 to November 12th, which is the council meeting which follows the next regular election. And it's my intention to take action on the third item with some amendments today.
That was Portland Mayor Charlie Hales at this morning's City Council meeting. Longtime local activist Joe Walsh was one of those who gave testimony opposing the proposed street fee and the process used by the council to push it forward.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. And I would like to give you an opinion that this entire operation, presentation, ordinance, fee, tax, whatever it is you want to call it, has been bizarre, absolutely bizarre. The fact that you're doing amendments, the people that are watching this on TV do not have the same paperwork you have. They don't know what you're talking about. You're looking down at paperwork and making notes on amendments, and people don't know what you're talking about, and that to me is terribly unfair. The other thing I would like to say is in this process, there were people that came here today to testify on specific items, and you make last-minute changes. And what you do is you say to us, as the public, screw you. You took the day off. You took hours off. You took the bus down here. You spent a couple hours to get here. Screw you. I am the mayor. I'm going to put it over. You could have put it on your website. You could have notified people, but you didn't. There are people here that took the time to come. You should be embarrassed that you do that kind of stuff. This is outrageous. This fee is outrageous. You're outrageous. You're outrageous. Thank you, you guys. For the first time in a long time, I can say thank you, Commissioner Salzman. Thank you, Commissioner Fish. And I don't know where you are, Amanda. I think you're lost.
That was Joe Walsh, also known as Lone Vet, speaking at today's City Council meeting in Portland. Lily Mandel also spoke at the meeting, questioning the process used by the City Council to push through the new street fee.
What bothers me about this whole thing, this haste makes so much waste all over this entire thing from the beginning until now, makes so much of a problem. It is haste and another thing that happened, which has, it's the tenor of the entire thing that bothers me terribly since I attended last Thursday. This was an attempt to separate us, the rich, the poor. They have to have regulations here. This is for this. And this attempt, and then fear came in. Yes, we must do this now. That haste part, now, right now, or all these horrible things are going to happen to you. I have not liked this from the moment I heard it. I'm going to say I've heard this before, this separation over any issue, be it fees or taxes or whatever it is. And this is what I heard last Thursday. And I am appalled by it. I do not like fear and separation in any decision you come up. I don't care what it is.
The business street fee proposal will not be addressed in the City Council again until November, but the commissioners and Mayor Hales say they are open to receiving public comments between now and then.
The company just hired by the City of Portland to provide security guards for City Hall and Union Station has become the target of a campaign challenging its involvement in child abuse in Israeli prisons. G4S is a British security firm that recently won a contract with the City of Portland to provide security for several city-owned properties. But the company is widely known for its role in operating and maintaining security for the Israeli prison system, which imprisons thousands of Palestinians, including hundreds of children. Many of the Palestinian prisoners are held under so-called administrative detention without charges or trial. The company is holding its annual shareholder meeting in England beginning tomorrow, Thursday, June 5th, and protesters are expected both inside and outside the meeting. Several organizations have documented the ill treatment of the children inside these prisons. The United Nations reported that the abuse of Palestinian youngsters trapped inside the Israeli prison system is widespread, systematic, and institutionalized. At its shareholder meeting last year, a number of concerned shareholders questioned the G4S board about the company's complicity in the detention and abuse of Palestinian children. The company promised to review the situation, but a year later, no such review has taken place. An online petition calling on G4S to divest from its Israeli prison contracts has been signed by South Africa's Archbishop Desmond Tutu, as well as leading academics Noam Chomsky and Richard Falk. The issue of the G4S contracts with the Israeli prison system was not brought up at the City Council's hearing to approve the contract with the controversial security firm.
Soldiers with the Oregon Army National Guard have been called up to serve in Afghanistan beginning later this month. This is the third time that the 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team has been mobilized to Afghanistan. Some of the 400 soldiers in the brigade have previously served tours in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The full brigade is scheduled to participate in a mobilization ceremony on June 7th in Salem and will head to Fort Bliss and Fort Hood, Texas for training prior to departure for Afghanistan. The battalions will provide security and support for military facilities in Kabul and southwestern Afghanistan.
A criminal investigation in Oregon has exposed links between white supremacist groups and outlaw biker gangs in a variety of criminal enterprises. The year-long investigation, codenamed White Christmas, has produced charges related to gun running, drug trafficking, identity theft, and the fencing of stolen property. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Department, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and a number of state and local law enforcement agencies were involved. Thus far, it has resulted in criminal charges against 54 Portland-area individuals, leading to 11 criminal cases in state court and an additional 54 federal court cases. Authorities say many of the Oregon suspects were affiliated with a number of white supremacist gangs. The prison and street gangs European Kindred and Rude Crude Brood were among those named. Other arrested were associated with the Gypsy Joker Motorcycle Club, who authorities say were involved in gun and drug trafficking with the white supremacist groups. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Department called the case by far the largest ever undertaken by this agency in recent memory. The breadth of the criminal activity is consistent with a reported increase in white supremacist activity nationally since 2008.
In the continuing fiasco involving Oregon's failed health care exchange, 80,000 Cover Oregon customers who signed up for the exchange will have to re-enroll with the federal government's exchange, healthcare.gov. State leaders had considered dumping the website, which failed to register a single customer. Overall, Oregon's health exchange cost $250 million. Last month, state leaders began the process of transitioning to the federal exchange, but a Cover Oregon representative confirmed today that customers must reapply. The federal health exchange does not do business with some private plans which were offered in Oregon, including Trillium, Providence, Health Republic, and Oregon's Health Co-op. Oregon health plan customers will not be affected. The federal government issued subpoenas in an investigation into the system's failure last month, and Governor John Kitzhaber last week said he planned to sue Oracle, the contractor who built the website.
Oregon is set to receive $3.8 million as part of a settlement with prescription drug giant GlaxoSmithKline. The settlement is part of a multi-state deal which results from a suit claiming that the drug giant falsely advertised three products, including the asthma drug Advair and the antidepressants Paxil and Wellbutrin. Oregon's Department of Justice was joined by Illinois in bringing this case. It alleged that GlaxoSmithKline marketed Paxil as safe for children and adolescents, although it had not been approved as such and can actually lead to higher suicide risk when taken by minors. They were also accused of marketing Wellbutrin as effective for weight loss and treating sexual dysfunction, although it had not been approved for those uses. In all, 44 states took part in the suit and will split $105 million. As part of the settlement, the drug manufacturer admitted no wrongdoing. In 2012, GlaxoSmithKline settled a federal suit for $3 billion for similar infractions.
If spring's numbers are any indication, Oregon's economy is on an upswing heading into summer. That's according to reports released by the state's Employment Department and the University of Oregon. Oregon job growth reached an 8-year high in April, according to the Employment Department, with more than 6,000 jobs added that month. Almost 9,000 jobs were added in March. Oregon's unemployment rate for the same time period was almost 7%. Together, those 2 months represent the largest jump in jobs growth since the end of 2005. This puts Oregon's job growth rate at 2.6%, almost a full point higher than the national average. The University of Oregon echoed the positive sentiments in a report released Wednesday. The college's Oregon Measure of Economic Activity reports that employers across the state hired an increasing number of workers this spring, while fewer Oregonians applied for unemployment benefits. These positive trends are floating Oregon's economy, with most of the added jobs in the healthcare, hospitality, trade, and professional services industries. Growth for the same period in the construction and finance sectors slowed. U of O's Index of Economic Indicators pointed to a slow but steady outlook for the state's economy as temperatures warm. Consumer sentiment is up and temp hiring is down in Oregon, according to the index. The numbers aren't completely rosy. Oregon took a much harder hit than other states did during the Great Recession and remains behind the curve in its return journey to pre-recession employment levels.
Dairy workers in Washington state have released new photographs showing sick and injured cows being milked at the Dairy Gold facility. Workers affiliated with the United Farm Workers released photographs that they claim show current conditions at several of the company's farms. The photos follow similar allegations made against the company earlier this month in a proposed class action lawsuit. The lawsuit claimed that some of the company's milk is produced by dairy cows who are injured and sick, and that its workers are denied drinkable water and meal and rest periods. KBOO's Alexi Horowitz spoke to United Farm Workers organizer Jorge Valenzuela for the story.
The United Farm Workers held a press conference in Portland at the end of last week. Could you explain what it was for and what happened?
The United Farm Workers and the Humane Society this Friday released new pictures of what workers are calling animal cruelty occurring at Dairy Gold Farms. Some of those pictures were as new as, you know, a couple of days old. And they were from four different farms that belonged to the Dairy Gold Cooperative. And what the workers explained to the reporters on Friday was that, you know, that type of abuse to the animals is rampant across Dairy Gold dairies, that it's very common to see cows that are injured or sick, like the ones that were depicted on the pictures.
And what is it that's actually shown in these photographs?
There were cows that were stuck under bars, and workers were telling us that it's normal, you know, for the cows to be stuck under those bars for hours or overnight, and sometimes they, you know, they choke themselves because there aren't enough people to be able to see those cows. One of the more impacting pictures was a picture of a cow that was being milked, and you can see the milking instrument being filled with blood. And workers explain that picture as it's very common when you're milking the cows that blood and pus will come out of the milk, and it will go into the instruments, and that milk will go into the general milk pool for Dairy Gold. And they explain as well that even though they will inform management that the cows are injured, that the very next day they will see the same animals there again with the same injuries, and that they're not receiving medical attention.
As far as you see it, is this more of an animal cruelty issue or a food safety issue or a mixture of both?
You know, what we're seeing is that it's a human rights issue. It's an animal rights issue, and that's what the workers are letting us know. Dairy Gold states that there is a process for the milk to be purified, but at the same time, you know, we have to care for the animals that are providing us this milk. And what we see is that the workers themselves are the eyes and the ears for these animals, and the ones who are in direct contact with these farm animals on a day-to-day basis, and the ones who can ensure that these types of abuses aren't occurring. One of the reasons workers are reporting that this is happening is that there is retaliation against them if they do not milk cows that are injured, or if they do not milk cows that are sick. So the workers who took these pictures were very brave workers and were able to get these images so that they could then expose them to the public and make the public aware about what's going on.
And how does the company seem to be responding at this point?
Well, we have not received a response from Dairy Gold. They have not communicated with us about what the best way is for this to come to a stop. What we did see is that they explained to reporters was that they themselves do not have a way to obligate the farms to, you know, stop the abuse. So, but what we're saying is, you know, Dairy Gold, you know, if you are claiming that the animals are being treated right, if you are claiming that workers are being treated right, then how can you, you know, not have these type of processes? So that's what we want. We want Dairy Gold to sit down with the workers, and we want them to, you know, come to a compromise in which farm animals and workers will be treated with dignity and respect.
This is Alexi Horowitz with KBOO News.
Biologists have confirmed the birth of two wild wolves in Oregon. The first wolf cub born in the state in over 50 years. The pups are the offspring of male wolf OR7 in an unidentified mate. They were born in a remote part of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. OR7, a wolf tracked by the state, became somewhat of a celebrity for his long journey, traveling 1,000 miles between Oregon and Northern California starting in 2011. Gray wolves were abundant in Oregon until they were extirpated in the 1940s. They started reappearing in the late 90s and remain federally protected as an endangered species, although many western states were allowed to delist them in 2011. In 2013, U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials proposed delisting wolves in Oregon. A decision on the matter is expected this year. Wildlife officials counted 64 wolves in Oregon last year.
A proposed ballot measure in Oregon will create an open primary election in the state. Ballot Measure 55 and its sponsoring committee wants to group all candidates into one primary rather than how the system in Oregon currently works. Right now, major party candidates have a primary in the spring, and third-party candidates register for the November election. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Here's the situation right now.
What we have in Oregon is a primary system that everybody pays for, but because about 33% of the voters in the state aren't registered with one of the two major parties, they don't get to participate in it.
That's Steve Hughes of the Working Family Party in Oregon, and he's explaining how the major parties tend to shut out third parties and third-party candidates. Ballot Measure 55, which is being sponsored by a committee called Every Oregon Voter Counts, aims to change that.
Well, I can tell you it has to do with how our primaries are run, our primary elections.
Tony Green is a spokesperson for the Oregon Secretary of State.
What I can tell you is the process. They have to gather approximately 87,000 valid signatures in order to get it on the ballot in November. The deadline is July 3rd.
Mr. Green says the committee's ballot measure proposal was approved by the Secretary of State's office on May 15th, and in 33 days, the committee has raised more than $162,000.
Well, it's really three core things.
Jim Kelly is the chief sponsor of Every Oregon Voter Counts.
One is to provide more choice. Two, a goal is less gridlock, make government more functional. And three is to make the voting process more fair and involve more people, more participation.
I understand that there have been little trials of this in the past in Oregon, and not too many unaligned people did it.
Art Robinson is the head of Oregon's Republican Party.
The only disadvantage I heard voiced was that it would cost the counties money because they have to identify, have some sort of handshake with the people who want to do it, but maybe that can be arranged. And it is true, a lot of Democrats have been switching to unaligned, probably some Republicans have.
As a group, Oregon's independents constitute about 35% of all voters in the state, while Democrats and Republicans are both less than that. And many conservative candidates especially feel that Democrats unhappy with Democratic policies have become independent, hoping that those votes will turn into Republican votes. But independent is not the same as non-aligned.
I mean, frankly, I don't think anybody's going to capture any voters anywhere. I think, you know, all voters are intelligent people who look at the issues.
Rob Harris is a spokesperson for Oregon's Independent Party.
And make their decisions on who to support based on, you know, what people stand for. And they have the voter's pamphlet to read those things, and they get information, you know, on the ballot in terms of, you know, how candidates are identified on the ballot.
Mr. Kelly, how are Oregon's third parties going to be affected by this ballot initiative?
Well, that's a good question, and they're very divided on this. But the process works now where minor parties can be on the general election ballot, but they really effectively cannot get elected. So the most they can do is to be a spoiler.
The best example of a spoiler in recent times was the effect of Ralph Nader on Al Gore's presidential campaign in the 2000 presidential election.
And ours is different, by the way, from Washington and California, in that candidates, if they accept it, our ballots will actually list what party has endorsed them. So in my view, this creates a situation where the major parties have less power, but boy, I would sure think that this makes it much more likely if you had a strong candidate coming out of a good third party, somebody maybe perhaps in Southeast Portland who was a member of the Working Families Party, and you had a great candidate who put together a great campaign. I think it makes it more likely that you could see somebody like that actually make it into the legislature, which, in my view, would be great.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with station co-managers Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw. News from the Boo, followed by treasures from the KBOO archives at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be clear and sunny, with a high of 77, with light wind traveling north by northwest. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are: counts per minute in North Portland, average of 32. Vancouver, Washington has an average of 28 CPM. Eugene, Oregon has an average count of 29 CPM. Hanford, Washington has an average of 29 as well. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has an average radiation count of 36 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1989, the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square protest in Beijing, China, were violently suppressed by the Chinese military. 241 people were killed. And in 1957, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous The Power of Nonviolence speech at the University of California, Berkeley.
It is 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The funny thing about Wall Street banksters is that they make a killing by defrauding millions of homeowners, customers, investors, and taxpayers. Then, when caught, they wonder why we don't love them. That's funny as in bizarre, not as in ha-ha. Still, it's hard not to laugh at Jamie Dimon, the vainglorious silver-haired boss of the J.P. Morgan Chase House of Banksters. Last year alone, the bank racked up a record level of regulatory fines for the recidivist criminal operation overseen by the boss. A little self-reproachment might have done him some good, but Dimon chose a funny way, again meaning bizarre, to express remorse. He's been running a Feel Sorry for Me campaign, claiming that he's the victim of this sordid story. Never mind his long rap sheet of malfeasance and incompetence, which cost so many so much. Jamie wails that everything from Wall Street's bailout to the pay of top bank executives have made people envious of bankers' success. Thus, he moans, an anti-Wall Street sentiment has spread through the public, prompting politicians and regulators to pander to this populist anger by persecuting enterprising bankers like him. He called the whole thing, quote, unfair. Good grief. This guy bills bank profits through rip-offs, piles billions of dollars in fines on the backs of shareholders, pockets $20 million in personal pay for 1 year's work, and he wants us to weep for him? Being a Wall Street boss, you see, means never having to say you're sorry, for it's always someone else's fault. This is Jim Hightower saying, only 25 years ago, more than 1,000 bankers were prosecuted for this sort of malfeasance during the savings and loan scandal. Let's return to the ethical accountability of those days. Or maybe we the people should send our own message to today's banksters by rolling a guillotine down the center of Wall Street.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Construction on an underground ice wall has begun at the Fukushima nuclear power plant that experienced 3 reactor core meltdowns during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. Currently, more than 500 tons of radioactive water from Fukushima flows into the Pacific Ocean daily. As groundwater flows under Fukushima, it mixes with other highly contaminated water before flowing into the Pacific Ocean. The ice wall is an attempt to freeze the ground in a circle around the 4 reactors that make up the Fukushima nuclear power plant, thereby stopping any groundwater before it becomes contaminated. The ice wall will be made up of over 1,500 pipes inserted vertically 100 feet into the ground and circulated with coolant that will freeze the soil and create an impermeable barrier. The ice wall will be 100 feet deep and 1 mile long, and it is estimated that it will cost more than $300 million. The severity of the contaminated water flowing under Fukushima has risen lately, as a recent test showed strontium levels from the basement of the reactor buildings to be more than 500 million becquerels per liter. There are more than 20 other highly radioactive substances also contaminating the water, including cesium-134 and 137, plutonium-239, and strontium. Strontium has a half-life of 29 years and mimics and replaces calcium in our bones. Underscoring the difficulty of the cleanup process at Fukushima, engineers are sounding the alarm over a chimney stack located between reactors number 1 and 2 that is deteriorating and beginning to list to one side. Radiation levels at the base of the chimney stack are at over 25 millisieverts per hour. Exposure to 2 millisieverts per hour would kill a human in 2 hours. The radiation levels are so high that even robot-commanded cranes can only operate for very short periods before breaking down. If the stack fell and hit either reactor building, the entire plant would have to be evacuated for the foreseeable future.
On Monday, Dr. Ken Buesler gave a lecture at Refugee PDX on how the crisis at the Fukushima nuclear plant is affecting the Pacific Ocean and what we can do to help. Buesler is a marine radiochemist and an expert on the effects of the Fukushima disaster in the ocean. He is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and specializes in the study of natural and man-made radionuclides in the ocean.
Fukushima has brought up a lot of issues both in Japan and for people here on this coast. And I've started kind of giving lectures this week up and down the coast to a whole range of people to see what do we know about this, how concerned should we be, and that's kind of part what our radioactive ocean is. It's a crowdfunding site, it's only 4 months old. Typically I'm a research scientist, an oceanographer, who writes proposals to the National Science Foundation, to NOAA, to DOE, anywhere we can find support for this type of research. And theme tonight is that we're not finding support for the Fukushima work. If you think about Godzilla, it was actually spawned after our early weapons testing. The two largest sites, in fact, of radioactivity in the Pacific are those test sites in the Marshalls and now Fukushima. We want to go back there and find out what's causing some of these. You know, they've had a second leak in December, and I just predict it's going to be decades before it's cleaned up. Hopefully only a few years, if you believe them, before they can clean up some of the other isotopes, but it's a waste site. The biggest change there is you look at the reactor and all you see are tanks, and they're running out of space. They have a boundary up beyond which they can't put radioactive waste. And these guys walk around. Again, I don't want to trivialize what's going on in the ocean, but I worry about the people on land. You have a tank leak, you send this guy out with a Geiger counter, and he sees a puddle, he puts his Geiger counter. He's getting 1,000 chest x-rays in an hour, kind of a dose. And in the ocean, if you're swimming in that water, you're getting about 10,000 times, actually, no, less than that, 100,000 times less of a dose in the ocean offshore if you swam in that water. So these guys are getting the high exposure, and they didn't at that time even have a way to look at the level of radioactive liquid in the tanks. You know, we have gasoline, every car has a gauge for your fuel. I mean, come on, this is radioactive waste, there's 1,000 tanks. So it's a bit of a mess on land, and that's of concern for a lot of reasons.
According to Dr. Buesler's research, radioactive contaminants from Fukushima are being carried across the Pacific Ocean by currents and spread along the west coast of North America by complex coastal processes. Models predict the radionuclides from Fukushima will begin to arrive on the west coast in early 2014, mainly in the north, and then will move further south in coming years before appearing in Hawaii in small amounts. The concentration of contaminants is expected to be well below the limits set by the U.S. EPA for cesium-137 in drinking water. More information can be found at the website rradioactiveoceans.org.
The Federal Communication Commission's public comment website crashed Monday night due to high traffic after the release of a video by television host and comedian John Oliver, which went viral. Oliver criticized a new FCC proposal to loosen net neutrality rules. The proposed changes would allow internet providers to charge different rates for differing data speeds. Critics of the proposal charge that it would undercut economic competition, freedom of speech, and equal access to the internet.
Net neutrality is actually hugely important. Essentially, it means that all data has to be treated equally, no matter who creates it. It's why the internet is a weirdly level playing field. And startups can supplant established brands. That's how Facebook supplanted MySpace, which supplanted Friendster, which supplanted actually having any friends. do you you remember physically having friends? It was awful. You couldn't tap people's faces to make them go away. The point is, the internet in its current form is not broken, and the FCC is currently taking steps to fix that.
That was comedian John Oliver talking about proposed FCC net neutrality rules.
More than 500 New York City police officers descended on two Harlem housing projects Wednesday morning, arresting 40 suspects in what authorities are calling the largest gang raid in city history. City prosecutors handed down indictments for over 100 individuals they say belong to gangs based in Manhattanville and Grant Houses, neighboring housing projects in Harlem. According to prosecutors, the gangs are accused of two murders and over 70 shooting incidents over the course of a turf war that has lasted more than 4 years. The violence was thrust into the media spotlight in 2011 after 18-year-old Tishana Murphy, a rising high school basketball star, was shot dead in the hallway of her building. Two members of a Manhattansville gang were later convicted of her murder. New York City Police Chief William Bratton called the raid necessary because the gang rivalry has turned the two housing projects and streets around them into a war zone. Those arrested are due to be arraigned on formal charges tomorrow.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. Israeli settlers attack protests organized in the West Bank in solidarity with hunger-striking detainees, and settlers destroy Palestinian-owned olive trees. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Palestinian-owned olive trees were damaged on Wednesday after Israeli settlers set fire on them near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. According to local sources, the settlers came from the illegal Israeli settlement of Havat Gilad. Palestinian firefighting brigades arrived at scene and put off the fire only after it destroyed dozens of trees. In related news, Israeli soldiers also set fire to Palestinian-owned olive trees in Hebron Old City in southern West Bank on Wednesday. Staying in Hebron, Israeli troops attacked on Wednesday midday a nonviolent protest organized by local activists in support of hunger-striking political detainees held by Israel. Local sources said that many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation after troops attacked the protest. Meanwhile, near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, clashes erupted between local youth and Israeli soldiers around the Ofer Military Detention Center. The youth organized a protest there in solidarity with the hunger-striking Palestinian political detainees. Local sources announced that three civilians were injured during the clashes by Israeli rubber-coated steel bullets. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Prisoner Society has issued a statement confirming that 60 political detainees being held by the Israeli army in the desert Beersheva prison of Eshel are currently engaged in a continuous hunger strike, and that each one of them are being held in solidarity confinement. Furthermore, Palestinian human rights organization Adamir has estimated that somewhere around 183 Palestinians are currently being held under administrative detention conditions without charges or trial. According to the Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli army are detaining 5,224 Palestinians. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 4th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has declared a landslide victory in national elections widely seen as a farce. Assad received a reported 88% of the vote, which grants him a third term in office. Voting was only held in government-controlled areas. Large portions of eastern and northern Syria, controlled by rebels seeking Assad's ouster, did not vote. This election marked the first time candidates were allowed to stand against Assad. In previous elections, dating back to the rule of Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, voters were only allowed to cast yes or no ballots. Syria still remains embroiled in a civil war dating back to 2011 that has killed an estimated 230,000 people and has displaced millions.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the Taliban has released video of the prisoner transfer of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, which took place in Khost Province. Five Afghan prisoners from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay were exchanged in order to secure his release on May 31st after 5 years in captivity. A remote-controlled bomb struck a marketplace in the northern city of Maimana, killing three people. The explosive placed in a thermos bottle, wounded 12, and announcing plans for the military withdrawal at the end of this year that will end the 12-year Afghan war, President Obama said that 1,800 troops of the planned 10,000, which will remain in Afghanistan, will conduct counterterrorism operations.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Alexi Horowitz and Maddie Clark, Yana Maximova, and Aaron J. Bernard. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jekka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-7525. 3386, and Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fagering presents analysis and commentary on a variety of issues, including the Russia-China deal and why W. Saxby Chambliss is an odious wretch. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach speaks with Phil Clay about his novel Redeployment, which takes readers to the front lines of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk remembers the great Maya Angelou, who died last week. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now I'd like to introduce KBOO's co-station managers Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, who are live with us in the KBOO studio for the second installment of a weekly feature, News from the Boo. This will be on each Wednesday at 5:45 p.m., and the phones are now open for your questions about the internal workings and future plans of KBOO Community Radio. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Mike Crenshaw is a conscious hip-hop recording artist, educator, writer, and community activist. Monica Beamer is the former executive director of Sisters of the Road, a local nonprofit group that operates a cafe for low-income communities. Good evening, Mike and Monica.
Hey, good afternoon.
Let's start by talking a little bit about your decision to apply as co-managers. Mike, what does this mean and how does it work?
So Monica and I have been colleagues for quite some time doing a lot of work, not paid volunteer work in social justice community around different causes. And because of that, when our previous jobs ended around the same time, we started speculating about the possibility of us sharing a job. because we're busy in a lot of other areas besides what we do to, you know, pay our bills, we thought it'd be a good idea if we could split a full-time job so that we would, neither of us would actually be tied to a 40-hour-a-week job.
Anything to add, Monica?
Yeah, I mean, this job was especially appealing to us because it was KBOO, and we were really excited about that. And I think it's important to say about, you know, co-management, collective management, that it's a great way to share your power and with each other and share skills and also bring complementary skills to KBOO. And it's also a really nice way to have a lot of support with each other.
Do you divide your duties? I mean, do you have a formal structure that you divide responsibilities, or do you do it on an informal basis?
It's, I mean, there are some things that have been formalized on paper, but there's actually a lot of overlap. So even though we have certain sections of work that we focus on paper, we found that in reality, we both end up supporting each other in a lot of those areas.
What's on KBOO's wish list for equipment and other items that the station would like to have donated?
Yeah, we have a few things that we need here at the station, and we wanted to put the word out in case any of our listeners can fill that need. We need one more new or lightly used 10-foot by 10-foot tent for our summer festivals and outdoor remote broadcasts, including, of course, the upcoming Blues Festival over the July 4th weekend. We also need 8 to 12 new or lightly used chairs. Typically, these chairs are called boardroom chairs for our meeting area. So, yeah, if anyone has these items to share, they could bring them down or email Monica at KBOO for more information on what is needed.
Great. Again, we're speaking with KBOO's co-station managers Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, who are live with us in the KBOO studio for the second installment of a weekly feature called News from the Boo. If you have a question for Mike or Monica, go ahead and call. The number is 503-231-8187. Monica, I understand that the station is currently trying to recruit a couple of new board members. So could you talk a little bit about what qualities you're looking for in board members and what kind of commitment it would entail?
Yes, it is. It's quite a big commitment to be on KBOO Board of Directors. Well, any Board of Directors, we figure it's about 15 hours a month. Is that right?
Yep.
And so, you know, an important factor is that folks have time and, you know, skills around finance and governance, which is what a board does, policy and direction. Larger goals, but also really important to us is that folks are really committed to KBOO's values, which are peace, justice, democracy, and human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change.
Mike, anything to add?
And having fun.
It can be fun.
I'm just playing. It just reminds me of my comrades, the Universal Zulu Nation, who it's peace, love, unity, and having fun.
What other stuff do we have coming up on KBOO that we can look forward to?
Not tomorrow, Friday is the 6th, right? Mm-hmm. We got Pitch a Tent, the 4th annual public campout designed to raise awareness around the criminalization of homelessness in Portland and across the nation. That begins at 10 a.m. Friday, June 6th, and will continue through midday Saturday. Participants in Pitch a Tent are from Right to Survive, and other people who are supporting Right to Survive and Right to Dream will set up tents in downtown Portland along the Rose Festival's parade route to highlight the houseless community and how they're criminalized. But house folks get a free pass to come down and camp out and take up space. So we'll have music and public speaking, and just come out and show your support or pitch a tent and stay overnight.
We have the Voices on the Ground Resistance and a Resilience Conference this weekend, Friday evening and all day Saturday, the June 6th and 7th as well.
Where's that?
That's going to be at PSU, the Social Welfare Action Alliance, and the School of Social Work is sponsoring that event. Sherry Honkala, a national activist and anti-poverty movement leader and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, is going to be the keynote speaker on Friday. And recently, Sherry was a vice presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2012 in the national elections. And Monica and I are both going to join Sherry and Paul Bowden from Western Regional advocacy project on a panel on human rights on Saturday at 11:30, and that'll be at PSU.
Any other events?
Saturday, June 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. is a real important concert, Free Them All, a benefit to support political prisoners, and Mike can say more about that.
So we're going to have live music, and we're going to have speakers. Ajamu Umi from the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Walita Imarisha is going to be speaking there. Fingerpaint Afro Jazz is a local trio and arts collective. Dave Rovix is going to be headlining. I'm also going to play a set. It'll be a good time, so come on out and support liberation for political prisoners. And do we have anything else coming up?
We'll also be marching in the Pride Parade with a proud KBOO contingent Sunday, June 15th, gathering at 10 a.m. We hope everyone will join us for that. And we'll be at the Good in the Hood celebration with a booth and remote broadcast. That's June 27th through the 29th at the Lillis Albina Park, Harriet Tubman Middle School, North Flint and North Russell Streets, and we hope to see everyone there as well.
Does KBOO still need help getting their float decorated? I saw an email out a few days ago.
There is going to be a work party on Saturday, so folks can email Monica at KBOO for more information about that.
The summer season is, at least pretty close to here. And KBOO has traditionally broadcast lots of festivals and events. Are we going to be doing the Blues Fest and the Pickathon broadcasting again this year?
Yeah, we certainly are. So things are going to start at the Blues Fest on July 3rd. That's the Thursday, I believe, at noon, and run for 3 days. So
how long have you two been at the helm now?
Since February.
Any observations to share a few months in?
Well, I think, for me, it just gets more and more fun. You know, new jobs are hard because you're learning so much. So it's relationships are super important. So it's been great to get to know folks more and learn more and just see the possibilities. And it also feels like the energy's really high here right now and folks are ready to do lots of work together. You know, we live in a really important moment in history and time together, and KBOO has an important role in bringing us together to do the right thing and change history right now. So we're pretty excited to be involved in that and pretty lucky. And what do you say, Mike?
I can't add anything more to that. It's true. KBOO is a huge resource and of huge importance, and we're just happy to be here. And in the city at large, in the community, we see a lot of support, and we hear a lot of support for KBOO and for us being here. So
can you talk a little bit more generally about the importance of a vibrant community radio station in our current media climate?
Well, we've got net neutrality issues. We've got consolidation of the media, which is basically consolidation of information as a resource. And consolidation of information as a resource and control over people's access to information is important in the consciousness of the people. And I think that the times we live in are very challenging in this society as well as globally for economic, political, and ecological reasons. And so the amount of information that we have access to that can help inform our consciousness in our communities and hopefully guide us in certain ways, as far as how we respond to some of the crises we're going to be facing. I think that community radio plays a very important role in that process because corporate radio isn't going to share the type of information that's going to help people. It's just trying to dumb people down and keep people stuck in certain patterns that actually contribute to the problems we face.
And KBOO also has great culture and great music that's super important to share with each other and celebrate. So,
Actually, just sort of on a tangent from what you were just saying, in an environment with increasing media consolidation, how can KBOO publicize the fact that, yeah, it really is out there? What can we do to promote ourselves as an alternative to an increasingly homogenized media landscape?
I think that interacting in arts and culture and education areas of human activity that everyday people have to deal with. People who are working people, people who are just trying to survive, who might not be working, people who have families. Those are the type of people that make up our communities and that make our communities vibrant. Anything that's working in society, that's working in our community, is working because there are people there that are making it happen. So we try to get out in the community and support events. We try to co-sponsor events. We try to have, we try to be a visible presence, and we try to be available to the community. If people need to come down here and interact with KBOO, then we're, it's possible for them to do so.
Thank you. We've been speaking with KBOO's new co-station managers, Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer. They're going to be joining us live on the air every Wednesday, as they have tonight at 5:45 after the KBOO Evening News. So be sure to tune in next Wednesday for more news from the Boo. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bam. 6 o'clock. Ooh. That was amazing.
Couldn't do more perfect.